imagine taking your generosity to the next level, impacting more lives and leaving a godly legacy for generations to come. Get ideas and strategies to do just that when you listen to these personal stories from high-level kingdom champions. The Kingdom Investor Podcast showcases business leaders who have moved from success to significance, sharing how they use worldly wealth for kingdom impact. Discover how they grew in generosity, impacted more lives, and built godly legacies. You'll find motivation, inspiration, and practical steps to grow as a kingdom investor.
Hello, and welcome to the Kingdom Investor Podcast. This is your host, Daniel White. Today, we interview Mark Whitaker. Mark's life story is so incredible that they made a movie out of it, starring Matt Damon as Mark Whitaker. Mark is currently the executive director of Coca-Cola Consolidated. He has a PhD in nutritional biochemistry from Cornell University and has been blessed with an incredible wife, Ginger. In this two-part episode, Mark tells us how he went from having his own private jet to 8 years in prison, and how God has transformed him and redeemed his life in the process. If you enjoyed this episode, please share us with your friends and write us a review. And without further ado, let's jump right into the show. Mark Whitaker, welcome to the Kingdom Investor Podcast. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for having me, Daniel. Look forward to being able to share today.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to this episode all week. And just so thankful that you are coming on the show and willing to spend your time with us and share your story. So I wanted to ask if you would just maybe share a little bit about who Mark Whitaker is.
Yeah, I would say I've got a tremendous passion for the whole faith at work, the faith at work movement, integrating faith at work, what we also call business as a mission. And I've had that passion for the last couple decades, but I've sure had a different passion in my 30s. It's amazing where God, where I was in my 30s, and then I got to know God and became a follower of Jesus, and in the journey I've been on the last 30 years.
Yeah, and I'm excited to, you know, kind of see, just hear, you know, that incredible story that you shared with me when we first met. About your life, really kind of before and after Christ, because it is a really cool testimony and story. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask you, how was it having Matt Damon play you in The Informant?
Well, he's my identical twin. I think your listeners can see that we look just alike. So, and I say that in a joking way. But, you know, we had a chance to share our testimony with him, too. The Hollywood version of the story, the director was an atheist, so he wasn't interested in the redemption story. He wanted a crime drama and ended with everybody in prison. So it captured where I was probably at age 32, but I'm 65 years of age now. So it definitely missed the last 30 years of the story that we have a chance to share today. But it was interesting to meet Matt Damon and to meet his wife. And my wife was also very engaged in talking with his wife. And I think Matt Damon and his wife, Luciana, were very encouraged to see a marriage survive all that it survived.
Yeah, that's really, really inspiring. So, hey, before we jump into, I guess, part A of Matt Whitaker, the pre-Christ story, would you pray for our listeners and just this time?
Yeah, absolutely. Father, what a blessing it is to be able to share here today, Father. And I just thank you for the story that you've given me the last 30 years. And I pray for the listeners, Father, that if any of those that don't know you, Father, I pray that they will get to know you when they hear what you've done in my life and my family's life. And for the ones that do know you, Father, I just pray that just have tremendous passion to continue to serve you, Father, after they hear one of the stories of where you took a life from ashes to beauty. So I thank you for our time today, Father, and just what a blessing it is to serve you. And I pray all this in Jesus' strong name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Mark. All right. So take us back to kind of the beginning and let's hear your story.
Yeah, I grew up near the Cincinnati area, north of Cincinnati, real small town, 1,000-people town. I was the only child to go to college out of four, in my family, and I had full scholarship. Went to got my bachelor's and master's at Ohio State University, and got my PhD in biochemistry from Cornell University. And my mom said I went and got a degree for everybody in the family. And full scholarship for 8 years. And I will say this, you know, looking back, I graduated from Cornell with my PhD in 1983. I would have been 25 years of age then. And it's when the biotech industry was exploding, Genentech was starting, and the job opportunities were just tremendous at that time to have a PhD in the biotech field. But I will say this, during my 8 years in a secular university, my parents were Christians and went to church with my parents. I would say probably was forced to go to church as a youngster. But I will say those 8 years in college, especially in the sciences, took me away from exploring God for sure. I can remember professors even saying, especially more in the Ivy League during my PhD at Cornell, I remember professors saying, if you're a Christian, you can't be a PhD scientist. You're a Christian, you can't be in my class. So I will say I never met one Christian professor during my 8 years of college. So if there was one, they were in a closet. So I will say I finished my 8 years of education as an atheist, not believing in God. And I finished my 8 years of college thinking that if you're a PhD scientist, you can't believe in God. It's evolution and Big Bang theory and Darwinism, and that's what I learned for 8 years. But it's amazing how things changed as time went on. So I entered that biotech world when it was exploding, not as a Christian, actually as an atheist. And I thought my parents, when I finished Cornell, I thought my parents were Christians because they didn't go to college. And I recall telling my friends that, yeah, my parents pray a lot and they're Christians, but they never went to college, so they don't know better. Because that's the way I learned during my 8 years of education. So the job market was amazing. When I got out, I remember my wife and I bought a big home right when I finished up at age 25, and first time having a second car after being married and was finishing college and first time having a washer and dryer instead of going to the laundromat. It was such a change, such a rapid change. And that was age 25. By the time I was 32, I was divisional president of 7 years from the time I graduated, divisional president of one of the largest companies in the world, known as ADM Archer Daniels Midland. Now, $70 billion in revenue, 30,000 employees, number 56 on the Fortune 500. Our CEO was 75 years old. Our president was 69, and I was 32, half the age of the three executives above me. I was ranked number four executive in the company at that time, divisional president of the biotech division of ADM, Archer Daniels Midland, number 56 on the Fortune 500. We were with those $70 billion in revenue that I'd mentioned. And I was corporate vice president of the company. So divisional president of one of the fastest growing divisions and corporate vice president of the whole company. My first week working here is October 1989. So we're talking well over three decades ago. And the first week, the CEO gave me a corporate jet, a Falcon 50. The seven top executives each had their own jet. This is my first week working there, being ranked number four, and the seven top executives each getting one of the seven jets. Well, I had my own jet, and I had that position for 8 years. So I had my own Falcon 50, could travel anywhere I needed, wanted to travel to on business. And within a couple of weeks' time, I bought the house that the CEO had lived in for almost 30 years. He was a billionaire, owned 5% of ADM, the largest single shareholder he was. And I'm talking about the 75-year-old CEO at this point. And he wanted to move to something smaller, so I ended up buying his house. My third week living there, with a startup bonus that they gave me, that was the down payment. And it was a 13,000-square-foot house with an 8-car garage, horse-riding stables where my children could ride in an inside horse arena in the wintertime, because it's located in Decatur, Illinois. So they're an inside arena when it's cold outside. We were about 3 hours south of Chicago, is where ADM's headquarters are. And also three golf greens on the property. I mean, it was a mansion. I'm talking about a very colonial, built in 1846, that was the original house of John Daniels, the founder of Archer Daniels Midland, 100 years earlier. And then it was the home of Dwayne Andreas, who lived there about 30 years, who was the CEO when I joined the company. So I felt like if you live in this home, you're eventually going to be the CEO of ADM, Archer Daniels Midland. And that was the home I bought my first month working there. And I tell you, probably the best way to describe it, I was Justin Bieber before Justin Bieber. I mean, the jet, the mansion, the bonuses I was getting, it was seven figures. My base salary was six figures, but with the bonuses and stock options, it was seven figures. For the 8 years I was there, it was seven figures each year. So I was making $2 or $3 million a year. I had the eight-car garage filled quickly with eight cars, a Ferrari, two BMWs, two Mercedeses, and so on. And I wonder why my wife was so happy driving a 10-year-old Jeep Cherokee, why she was so happy driving that. And she always said she wanted to be a good steward for God. She became a Christian age 30. So by the time I started working there, she was a Christian. I met my wife when she was in seventh grade and I was in eighth grade. We went to our high school proms together. So we're high school sweethearts. She went to Ohio State when I also went to Ohio State we got married right before I went to Cornell to get my PhD. But she became a Christian at age 30. Her mom got real ill, was in the hospital at age 52 for almost 10 or 11 months, her mom was. And during that journey, Ginger became a Christian. So she was a Christian at that time. And as a scientist, I couldn't believe in God. And I every once in a while I would mention, I said, you know, I learned to the opposite when I was in college, you know, for those 8 years when I was in the sciences. And Ginger would tell me, she said, well, she believes in God. She knows God exists. She can feel him in her heart. She had the Holy Spirit in her heart. And I was so addicted to my work. And the more I worked, the more performance bonuses I would get, because 90% of my income was in bonuses. So therefore, as long as she was busy, I was happy. But I could not understand why she believed in God. And I had a red Ferrari. I said, Ginger, I'm happy to buy you a yellow one. And she said, no, you know what? My Jeep is doing just fine. My 10-year-old Jeep. But I couldn't understand how she was always so content with what she had when all I wanted was more and more. I just couldn't understand that until later in life. So we're a couple of years with a company now. I was obsessed with a company, obsessed with my work, became almost an addiction. Ginger was very active with the church and her women's group and Bible studies on Monday and Thursday evenings. And I'd go to church with her, just like my parents forced me to go to church. I'd go with her and the kids, but it was one ear and out the other. I was not listening. And she was so engaged in church. And like I said, I was happy with that because it allowed me to work more because I saw that she was so busy with the church and with their Bible study women's groups. Couple of years with the company, to fast forward, now I'm 34 years of age. The CEO is now 77. The president is now 71. So everybody's aged a couple of years. And the vice chairman came back to my office and gave me this huge bonus, gave me lots of stock, more stock, and gave me a $100,000 check. Almost that day alone was like $1 million, just that day alone. In April 92, he said, Mark, now you're part of the family. You've been with us a couple of years. We trust you completely. We're going to start sharing with you some things that how we do business. And I started thinking, well, I've been here 2 years. I know how you're doing business. I'm corporate vice president of the company. He said, no, I'm going to share some things with you that we've not shared. And he started sharing how they were working with their competitors for well over a decade and fixing prices of ingredients. And he didn't use these words, but he was describing the international cartel, a price fixing, which is highly illegal because of antitrust laws. And he started describing that, and that's been going over a decade. He said, now that they trust me, and because the age of the other ones above me, that at some point I'm going to have to take over this international cartel. So they needed to bring me into the loop and start mentoring me how to do this. And first thing I brought up, I said, well, that's illegal to do that. And they said, Mark, it's illegal, but the politicians that put antitrust laws on the book, books. They didn't know anything about business. They did that in the 1800s. And they said, Mark, I can tell you for a fact, if you're in the commodity business, this is the way you have to do business. And here I thought, I'm less than a decade out of Cornell at that point, out of college. They've been doing this for 3-4 decades. This must be the how the real world works, is how I thought. And they just gave me $1 million an hour earlier. So yeah. I sold my soul. I was hook, line, and sinker all in. And I thought, well, this is how the world works. They described 11 other companies involved. So I thought, well, everybody must be doing this. So I got involved with the price fixing scheme. I started being mentored. I just couldn't walk away from all the compensation. I knew if I said no, my future there was finished. How can you move up if I'm not willing to be mentored by the top executives of the company to eventually take their place? That I had to be mentored if I'm going to continue to move up the ladder. So I didn't see a choice, either leave the company or do it. And I was not willing to walk away from all those bells and whistles that I had, the jet, the mansion, and the lifestyle that I had. So a few months later, Ginger's talk, we're having a conversation. And the FBI, when I started with ADM, the FBI was helping with the Chicago Board of Trade case as soon as I started. So, I mean, the FBI was consistently at ADM and assisting with these smaller cases. And it was kind of odd because here they're helping us with cases, and then this huge price fixing case is going on right under their noses, which is a lot larger than the cases that they were ever helping with. And they were helping with a contamination case where they were working with ADM and helping us because ADM is the largest company in Decatur, Illinois. 80,000 people live in Decatur, Illinois. 30,000 people work for ADM. So it's kind of a company town. And so the FBI did do some work to help ADM when ADM had some challenges, especially if it was breaking federal laws when things were stolen and going across state lines and things of that sort. And so I was telling Ginger, I said, it's kind of odd that here we are, FBI helping us. There's this huge case. And I said, I'm always nervous to talk to the FBI because I know I got this big price fixing case that we're engaged with. And she said, what do you mean price fixing case? And I said, well, the last 7 months, they're mentoring me to take over a cartel they've been having for well over a decade. And I've been involved for the last 7 months, and I started sharing with her what they're mentoring. I've known Ginger since seventh grade, and I just started sharing what was going on. And she said, Mark, is that legal? And I said, well, Ginger, it's not legal, but they told me everybody does it. If you're in the commodity business, this is what you have to do. And she said, how much does a company earn by doing this fraud? And I said, well, we're $70 billion in revenue, about $4 billion in profit. I said, we make hundreds of millions of dollars extra profit, sometimes $1 billion a year extra profit from the price fixing. So it could be 10 to 20% of our, even 25% of our profits. So it's one of the reasons why our stock price continues to increase as fast as it does. And we were doubling our stock every 3 or 4 years at this point. This would have been 1992. And she said, Mark, who pays that extra $1 billion a year or hundreds of millions of dollars a year that the company's earning from the cartel? And I said, well, basically the consumers do, because our customers are Kraft and Pillsbury and Tyson Foods and beverage companies like iced teas and orange juices and sodas and Coca-Cola and so on. I said, they're our customers, because we're the largest food additive company in the world. So basically, if a Kraft or a Kellogg's pays higher for an ingredient, they have their profit margin built in. They're going to just charge, it's going to be a higher price cereal or a higher price processed food or beverage in the grocery store. So I said, the consumer really pays it. And she said, you mean my grandma on $200 a week Social Security, and her largest expenses are groceries? He's paying for this, and we live in a mansion with an 8-car garage. She said, Mark, I can't believe you're involved with a fraud like this. She said, it just breaks my heart that you would get involved with it. I said, Ginger, we make millions of dollars. We live in a mansion. Our kids go to private schools. I'm flying around the last couple of years on a corporate jet. I'm probably going to be eventually the next CEO. I'm already divisional president and a corporate vice president. I'm going to be eventually the next COO or a CEO of this company someday. I'm half the age of the executives above me, and this is what I have to do to move up. And she said, you know what, Mark, I'd rather have a 2,000 square foot house, a Ford in the driveway, and have my husband back.
Mm. Wow.
She said, you've sold your life to this company and you don't even spend time with her or three young children. She said, you've become addicted to this company and all these, this materialism and power. And she said, she just wasn't the person she fell in love with in high school and in college. And it was hurt to hear all that, obviously, to hear all this, but it was true, but it was hurtful to hear it. And she said, how long's the case been going on? I said, well, they've been doing this cartel for almost 12 years and I've been involved 7 months. Now that I'm part of the family and they trust me, they brought me into it. And she said, Mark, she said, I don't know if I can live with this. She said, our old family, her dad works at a factory. Her mom works at Procter & Gamble. Her dad works at Ford. Her grandma's on Social Security. And she said, they're all paying these higher food prices because of what we're doing at ADM, the largest food additive company in the world. And she asked me, the whole company, you know, but I said, well, no, obviously not the whole company. I said, most employees are come to work on the right thing morally and ethically every day. It's just a few top executives that are involved, a handful. So it's not the whole company, but it's the top executives that are part of this. And she said, well, I'm going to have to pray about this. We'll talk about it later, but I'm going to have to pray about it. And she went to her study and she prayed for a couple hours. And she came back out, it's November 5th, 1992. I'm 34 years of age. She's 33, 2 years at ADM at that point. And she said, Mark, God led me to a decision. God has given me clarity. And I was thinking, good, I've got to get back to my price fixing meeting because a lot of these meetings are, Asia is 12 hours ahead of us. So 7 or 8 o'clock in the evening, Decatur, Illinois is 7 or 8 in the morning, and South Korea and Singapore and Japan, where our competitors were located. And she said, well, I don't think you're going to be having any meetings here today. She said, God's led me. You've got to turn yourself into the FBI and you got to do it today.
Wow.
I said, Ginger, I could go to prison for breaking antitrust laws. It's a federal violation. I said, our CEO is a billionaire. He's best friends with President Clinton. He owns 5% of a $70 billion company, the largest single shareholder of the company. I said, he will destroy us. I said, he's on a phone on a regular basis with President Clinton. He flew to President Nixon's funeral on President Clinton's plane. I said, this is a good friend of the U.S. president. I said, they will destroy us. And she said, you know what, Mark? God will protect us. She said, I don't think you go to prison. You're only involved 7 months, and it's been going on for a decade. But if you do, I'll stay with you. But we're going to do it, and we're going to do it today, and there's no discussion about it. I'd rather be homeless, she said, than live in a house where illegal activity is going. And she said, God put on her heart to turn me in today. And I said, Ginger, and we talked for a couple hours, and we argued, and it was a very heated discussion. But that very day, the very FBI that was assisting with us on a contamination case and other cases even prior to that, ADM, I was sharing with them that ADM's even doing a bigger case right under their noses. And Ginger was sitting by my side, and I kept telling the FBI they got a lot more bigger things to do. They got drug dealers in Decatur. There's a lot bigger things they could be doing than talking to me. And they said, now, what are we talking about? And I said, like I said, you got a lot more important things to do than talk to me. And Ginger said, it's $1 billion. He said, $1 million. She said, no, $1 billion case. He said, $1 billion. He said, how long's that been going on? And I said, you got drug dealers in Decatur. You got all this going on. I can't imagine we'd be important to talk to. Ginger said, it's been going on for 12 years. So Ginger shared all the truth of what was going on. And this became the largest price fixing case in U.S. history, started by a stay-at-home mom raising 3 young children. A case that was going on for over a decade. A case that involved hundreds of millions of dollars theft every year, and sometimes $1 billion, up to $1 billion a year, started by my wife, Ginger. So if there's anybody a true whistleblower, it's her, not me. And at the end of that, Ginger acted like my attorney. She said, look, Mark did the right thing. He's only involved a few months. We can go home now, right? And the FBI said, look, Mark too fast. Ginger thought they would just tap. We thought they'd just tap phones and do whatever they do. We didn't know I would have to do anything in assisting them. But they said, Mark either has to start wearing a wire tomorrow or be arrested today. And that's how I became an FBI informant. The next day I met the FBI, 6 a.m. They shaved my chest. They put microphones on my chest. And I was wired up and wore a wire for the FBI every day, Monday through Friday, every day for 3 years, 1992 to 1995, involving one of the biggest international cartel cases in history. At the time, it was the biggest at that time. And so I've been wearing a wire every day at that point, starting in 1992. And they had a green lamp that had the video camera in it. And this green lamp looked like it came from a yard sale. And I would tell the FBI where the meeting, the next cartel meeting was going to happen. They would make sure this green lamp would get in the room. And they could control from the next room through a monitor, watching on a computer screen. They could control the camera and zoom in whoever was talking. And if someone's writing on a, there was not a whiteboard back then, it was a flip chart. If someone's writing on a marker, on a flip chart, they would zoom in what was being written, you know, as we're divvying up the market, telling which company's going to take Tyson Foods and which one's taking Purdue Farms and, you know, surgically just splitting up the market in order to drive the prices up, sometimes threefold, fourfold, fivefold, where each company was making hundreds of millions of dollars a year extra, not just ADM. But each company in this international cartel. So this green lamp had the video camera in it. I remember it being in the Shangri-La Hotel in Singapore. They even had to put the voltage change to take it from 110 volts to 220 volts. And I remember it being in there 5 feet from sitting from everybody, 11 people in the room, and this green lamp's in there. And a few weeks later, it's at the Mandarin Hotel in Hong Kong, same 11 guys. Same lamp, 5 feet from them. A few weeks after, the Four Seasons Hotel in Chicago, and then a Sheraton Hotel in Maui. That green lamp was at 2 or 3 meetings a month. The same co-defendants for 3 years.
Oh my goodness! They didn't change the color of the lamp.
No, same lamp. And I tell you, I look back and I say, thank God there was not a woman criminal among us. Because I'm convinced if there was a woman, she would have said, this green lamp has fallen around the world.
Right.
but it also showed me, Daniel, that greed blinds you. Mm. They saw the millions of dollars bonuses that each were going to get, that they didn't see what was sitting 5 feet from them, that no matter what country they were in, it was the same lamp right there 5 feet from their face. Greed absolutely blinds you. And I saw it firsthand as an informant. So this happened for 3 years. The FBI was so appreciative. They would wire me up, and they started this the first few weeks. They said, Mark, this is dangerous. If one of this is a cartel that's involving billions of dollars, it's involving international people around the world. People are likely going to go to prison. They're going to pay hundreds of millions, if not more, in fines and class action suits, that if they catch you wearing a wire, your life could be in danger. And I started hearing that my first couple of weeks. People thought I had cancer. I started losing lots of weight. People thought I was sick at work. I mean, I was falling apart. I was blowing the driveway off at 3 a.m. with a gas leaf blower during thunderstorms. I was absolutely falling apart. The most stressful years of my life, thinking, what are they going to do if they catch me wearing a wire? And then I thought, what are they going to do when I'm at a federal trial, a witness against them? And I thought, these guys are going to absolutely kill me. And it was just the most stress in my life. So the FBI was so appreciative, wearing a wire so long, they got me a full immunity agreement, not to be charged for those 7 months where I was involved before, you know, I shared with the FBI. So never to do one day in prison, never become a felon, and never be part of this case except a witness in the case, because they were so appreciative. All I had to do was stay out of my own way and never to be charged. Now, a few months before the case came to an end, they told me it's the last few months. They have almost all the evidence they need. Multiple products started being involved. That's why it took so long. People would brag about their illegal activity. You know, it started off a lysine case, and people started bragging about price fixing on citric acid, and then it became another ingredient, then lactic acid. It just became multiple frauds and multiple products and multiple cases by people bragging about it. And that's why it became almost 3 years wearing a wire at that time. So the FBI told me it was coming to an end. I looked at, well, how am I going to keep, I'm addicted to that lifestyle at that point. I mean, the mansion, the jet, the horses, the riding stables, the country clubs. I couldn't imagine life not like that. And so I started thinking, how am I going to keep this standard of living when the FBI told me it's coming to an end, that I'm likely going to lose my job because when they learn that I'm wearing a wire, they're going to ask me to leave. I'll be fired that day. So I have to prepare for that. And then I thought, who's going to hire somebody who wore a wire for 3 years against their own company? It's almost easier to get a job as a felon than someone who wore a wire against their own company. I said, and I'm still in my 30s. I was 38 at that point. I said, it's going to take me years to get back on my feet. And I thought, well, how am I going to keep the standard of living during those years when I don't have a job? And I started looking, you know, kind of looking at my accounts, how much money I had saved. I looked at my stock options. There was one set of stock options. It was $9 million. It was about a year from being exercised, where I could exercise them. So I was going to get fired about a year before the exercise date, because it had a five-year exercise date. And for that particular set of stock options, I was about 4 years into it. So I couldn't exercise those. And I'm not going to be able to exercise, I'm going to be fired. So I decided, you know, I think I've got a PhD from Cornell. I'm the smartest guy in the room at the time. I'm just telling you what I was thinking. I was under a lot of pressure, staying up 2 or 3 in the morning, not sleeping at night for 3 years, not thinking clearly. And I wrote 5 checks over a couple months to myself for $9 million, thinking if it ever came up, I got stock options signed by the general counsel, stock options signed by the CEO of the company. They owe me $9 million. And then, you know, a jury or federal authorities could say, well, why would you cash me a year early? Well, I'm working for the FBI and I'm going to get fired before I could exercise them. What jury would not be sympathetic to that? I was thinking. So I wrote the 5 checks thinking I'm the smartest guy in the room, had $9 million to get back on my feet, and had some other money saved too over those years prior to this point. The day that ADM learned that I was the mole, that I was the one wired, the very day they called the FBI and said, look, Mark Whitaker's no white knight informant. He stole $9 million from us the same time he's working for the FBI. And so the FBI show up at my house and they have Ginger and I in the family room and they ask, what about this $9 million? And I share with them, well, they owe me that. I have stock options to justify that. And I showed the stock options, you know, I had everything ready, had all my evidence in hand. And Mark, you can't exercise stock options a year early. The Securities Exchange, the SEC, has rules and regulations and laws. That's what exercise dates are about. Who knows what that stock price would even be a year from now? It may have been higher, may have been lower, but you've got to exercise them when they can be exercised. That's what that date is. That means when those stock are vested, based on the number of years that stock options was granted, you just can't write checks to yourself. That's theft. So we understand your logic, but you can't do it that way. You're going to lose your immunity agreement. They said, Mark, we're going to go to the federal authority, prosecutors, and we're going to meet with them. We're going to get the best plea agreement we can get for you because we knew you were under pressure. We understand your logic of what you were thinking behind it. But you still broke the law. It's embezzlement. It's fraud. It's theft. You can't cash your stock options on your own. There's a process, as you've always used the years earlier, you got to follow that process. And just because you're an informant, you can't change the process. So they went to federal authorities. My lawyer called me in Chicago, said, come into Chicago. I was already fired from the company, obviously, with the day they learned that I was informant. And the attorney said, Mark, the FBI got you 6 months. They're going to give you a 3-year plea agreement, 3 years, but they're going to go in front of the judge and ask for mitigating circumstances, all the help you gave, wore a wire for 3 years, and they're going to ask for 6 months, and you're probably going to get very likely a 6-month sentence, 6 months. in federal prison. You go in at age 38, you come out at 38. Deal of a lifetime, Mark, for this $9 million mistake. Deal of a lifetime. And this is all because of your cooperation, you're getting this deal. Ginger looked at me and she said, Mark, I beg you to sign this. I looked at Ginger and I said, Ginger, you're the reason I'm in this mess in the first place. I said, Ginger, I've had to wear a wire for 3 years because of you. I ripped up that plea agreement, fired the lawyer who recommended it, and fought the case, hired new lawyers the next day, fought the case in the courts for 3 years to get 8.5 years in prison instead.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had a 6-month plea agreement in my hands. 6 months. And I went to 8.5 years. I got pulled my car in one of those garages, wrote a 17-page letter to Ginger and my 3 children, and I tried to kill myself. I couldn't imagine. I went from full immunity that I had to a 6-month plea agreement, which was a deal of a lifetime. And now 8.5 years for all the mistakes I made. And this is 3 years after fighting in court. So now I'm 40 years of age. I would have went in 38, got out at 38. Now I'm 40 and not getting out until age 49.
Oh, wow.
And so I tried to take my own life. I was hospitalized for a month, treated for post-traumatic stress disorder, had to see psychiatrists every day for quite a while. And treated for PTSD and some of the things that happen when you wear a wire for 3 years. And I mean, I was a basket case, but I still had to show up for prison. I had 7 months before I had to show up to prison for 8.5 years, 7 months to get back on my feet. And someone read about that in the newspaper, everything that I just shared to your listeners. And someone read about it. And his name was Ian Howes. He was COO of a biotech company. 5 young children, school age and younger, a couple of them adopted, his wife an attorney. God put on his heart to reach out to me, and he reached out to me, someone I didn't know, and he said, Mark, prison is going to be the beginning of your life, and you're going to find your true purpose in life with the journey you're ready to start. And I'm thinking, I'm about ready to go to prison for 8.5 years. How can he be thinking this way? I said, this guy's crazier than I am. I remember telling my wife, this guy's crazier than I am. And she said, that can't be. And then I told her when he said that prison will be the beginning of my life. And Ginger fell to her knees. And she said, Mark, I've been praying for you for 10 years. And your parents have been praying for you their whole lives. She said, I pray you go out and listen to this man that God sent. Because you haven't listened to us. But I pray you go listen to this man because God sent this man. And she was in tears. And I went out and I said, Ian, what do you have in mind? He said, I'm going to introduce you to God. I'm going to introduce you to Jesus. And I said, Ian, I've been going to church almost my whole life with my parents as a youngster and with Ginger these last several years. And so I've already go to church. He said, Mark, I'm not talking about going to church. I'm talking about a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. And I said, Ian, how do you do that?
This concludes part 1 of 2.
What if you could take your generosity to the next level, impacting more lives in your community and around the world, creating a godly legacy for generations to come? Now you can. Your first step is crafting your kingdom investing thesis. Reserve your spot in our next online workshop where we guide you through the process of discovering your passions, create a strategic plan, and connect you to opportunities that will help you fulfill your God-given calling as a kingdom investor. Register today by clicking the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next time for another episode of the Kingdom Investor Podcast.